comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks, and welcome to the Kevin Smith Show. Wherever you happen to be on this beautiful planet, thanks for being here at the Kevin Smith Show. It is talk radio like nowhere else on earth. It's the show where you matter. Now, there was a big earthquake over in China, right in the region of Tibet, right along the border there, province line or whatever you call it, but it was rather devastating. 589 confirmed dead as of just before showtime. So it was a big deal. The earth continues to shake, rattle, and roll, and the earthquakes just seem to keep coming bigger, faster, more often, and more devastating. Are you subscribed to the K-Files e-zine? Now, once in a while, I get an email from someone that says, I looked all over your site for the K-zine, and I couldn't find any place to subscribe. I've mentioned this before. That would be because there is no such thing as the K-zine, and there never has been any such thing as the K-zine. It is the K-Files. The K-Files is an e-zine. That means an electronic magazine or newsletter. But if you're not subscribed, you need to subscribe. Because first of all, it's free. Second of all, and this really should have been first, it's good. It has a lot of good information in it. You get the scoop on what the inside scoop on what's going on here at the show. In addition to that, you always get some interesting articles of things happening around the world, links to interesting videos, audience feedback, free download, and the whole thing's free. I mean, really free. We don't use DC doublespeak here. It's free. And you can unsubscribe anytime you want to. So if you have not yet subscribed, be sure you do that today by getting over to my website, kevinsmithshow.com. And you'll see the link right there. Also, let me encourage you, if you have not joined our members area, and we got, I get emails from people around the world who are debating and have debated for 3, 4, 5 years on whether they ought to join the members area. Well, I tell you what. If you will do this, you will join the members area really quick. Here's what you do. Take 23 cents out of your pocket, take it to the toilet, drop it in, and flush it. Do that every day, because you're wasting 23 cents every day on something that could give you access to the members area, where we've got lots of goodies, lots of good stuff in there. And so, you know, it's either you can spend that 23 cents to get something really worthwhile, or you can just flush it down the toilet because you're wasting it on something out there. How about joining the members area today? Then you can watch the show and get in on all the other good stuff too. We'll be back with Mr. James Horak right after this. I got an email today from someone. Actually, it was an email to Bob, our producer, that was forwarded then to me, saying Bob and I must really be good friends for him to put up with me. I believe it said taking the mick out of him like I do. And the answer to that is yes, we are. Bob and I served together over in Bosnia. He was my boss in Bosnia, and he is the producer of the Kevin Smith Show. And yes, we are good friends. Another person that I consider a friend, though I've never met him face to face, we've had many telephone conversations, long telephone conversations, and even before I asked him to be a guest on the show, we had a long telephone conversation, and that is Mr. James Horak. And he is just an amazing wealth of information, and he is my guest again this evening. James, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show.
Good evening, Kevin.
James,
I do consider you a friend, too.
Well, thank you. In your previous visits here, we've talked about a wide range of topics, a wide range of information, and in at least two of those visits, maybe three, you have mentioned that while you were serving in the Navy, you were on board a ship, you had a UFO encounter that resulted in you receiving a medical discharge from the Navy. But we've never delved into the details of that, and I'd like to begin there this evening. If you don't mind, I'd like to hear the details of this encounter and why it caused you to get a medical discharge.
I was on the USS Kennebec, which is in the Auxiliary Navy. It was an oiler. We were in Sasebo Harbor, Japan, just before Christmas, 1962. And we had a rather irresponsible captain. And he had his heart set on winning a hash mark for the ship, which is a mark that's put on the stack, and it means you did very well during an admiral's inspection. And because we had an admiral's inspection and didn't get the hash mark, he was in a tear. And he seemed particularly miffed with my division. So he put us to work. We didn't get to eat all day. And then we worked through the night. Around 3:30 or 4 in the morning, maybe a little earlier, the work was called off. And everyone went to crew's quarters, except me. I was told to put all the gear away on the well deck. So I proceeded to do that. About 10 minutes into my putting the gear away, I have a strange feeling, and I go to the rail. And I look out, and I see lights coming in from the sea and lights coming in over the mountains, and they join and form a V directly over me. And at that time, I wasn't aware there was anyone around to see what happened, but I explained before what had happened when I was 4 years old, the same thing happened. I feel this revulsion. I look inside these ships and I see these creatures. I can actually get inside them and I destroyed them. I knew they were going to destroy me. It's purely self-defensive.
How do you look inside these ships? Is it like psychic vision. You're able, or astral travel. You actually transport your spirit into the inside. How do you do that?
I get inside the computer that's driving them.
Okay, how? Mentally?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. All right, I got a question or two here before we go further into this story. This ship's captain made your division work, that included you, made you work all day and into the night, and would not allow you to eat. Is it legal under the military code? Is it legal to deprive personnel of food?
No.
Was this guy ever disciplined for having done that?
I believe he lost his command.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure. I was contacted later on while I was in a naval hospital in Japan by one of my crewmates, who told me that a lot of strange things had happened on the ship after I left.
Okay, now I want to get into those strange things later in the story. But it's your understanding, or at least your belief, that he lost his command over that.
I would suspect so, because the various members of the crew went in all directions.
Mm-hmm. All right, so how close, when you see these UFOs come over the ship and form a V formation, how close are they to you? How high up are they?
They're about 200 feet up.
So they're not very far up.
No.
And were there other crew members that saw these UFOs?
Yes, there were. I heard them talking about it whenever I got into my rack that morning, and they were talking about there were about three or four of them that were talking together. Now I don't know how many saw it, but I know that at least two did, because they were talking about what they had seen.
Do you have any idea what happened to those two subsequent to the sighting?
No, I have no idea what happened to them. The person that contacted me later on, when I was in the Kuska Naval Hospital, simply said that he hadn't seen it, but he said that there were several that had seen it. I couldn't get an idea just what several meant, but at least two, and they were probably all in my division, because except for those that were on the watch, it would have only have been men that were in my division, because we were the only ones working. It would have been up.
All right. Now, now this sighting is while the ship is in the Sasebo Harbor, right?
Yes.
Okay. So it's possible, since it was in the harbor, that there were people on land that also saw this. Did you ever hear any reports of people on land that saw it?
No, I didn't. I mean, I didn't stay in the vicinity very long after that. I was taken the next morning when I jumped out of my rack for reveille. I was under a sedative and hadn't eaten the day before, so I just passed out, and that's when they decided to take me over to the hospital in Sasebo.
All right, now, when you're standing at the rail and you look up and you're able to see what's in these ships that are above you, you have a sense of revulsion, and you did something to make them go away.
Yes.
All right. Now, what happens immediately after that?
It took everything I had, and the next thing I know, I'm sitting on a pipe, and there are men around me. One of them is the chief corpsman, hospital corpsman, and he's pulling me up, and I notice that my shoes are off, and I said, wait, let me get my shoes on. And he says, "Horik, we've been trying to get your shoes on for 20 minutes. And from then on, it took me up to sick bay, gave me a sedative, and I went to try to get a couple of hours sleep, and it wasn't enough.
So you had about 20 minutes, at least 20 minutes, of missing time. 20 minutes where you were out of it. You didn't know what was going on around you. Because the corpsman said, "We've been trying to get your shoes on, get you to put your shoes on for 20 minutes.
Yep.
Do you have any idea about other missing time in that event? In other words, is there any time missing before the corpsman gets to you?
I really wouldn't know. I've tried to think back on that. All I can recall is that I have the reaction. It just takes everything out of me, and I just lose consciousness. I don't remember turning away from the rail. The people that were with the chief seemed to think that I was going to jump ship because my pants were undone, my shoes were off, my shirt was unbuttoned.
But just minutes before, you had been properly dressed.
So I was, well, at least 20 minutes. May have been longer than that. I don't know how long I've been sitting on that pipe before they found me.
How far is that pipe from where you were standing at the rail?
Oh, about 6 feet.
Okay. So the next morning, you jump out of bed, and because of the sedative and the fact that you'd not been allowed to eat for 24 hours, you passed out. Now what happens?
Well, I'm passed out, and the next thing I know is the chief standing over me again saying, "Okay, Horik, we're going over on shore," and so they took me over to a hospital in Sasebo. It was a naval hospital or a military hospital. And I was there just a couple of days before they sent me to Akuska.
Okay. Now, Akuska is a major naval installation in Japan, right?
Well, it's a naval hospital, and it's a huge hospital. It was the largest military hospital, the Japanese military hospital the Japanese had in World War II. And it's extraordinarily big. It has a corridor that's over a mile long.
Wow. All right. So you get to Akuska, and what transpires at Akuska?
When I was at Akuska, I was put in with people that had nervous problems or had stress, different types of things, mostly Marines. And we had group therapy, and it was an open ward. And I was introduced to a very odd fellow who latched on to me like a second skin, and he followed me around wherever I went. And he was very unusual in many respects, and we started going on liberty together and got in trouble one night.
What sort of trouble?
Well, this gentleman was an SA, which meant he was one pay grade below me. I was an E3. He was an E2. He's 35 years old, speaks five languages, was a native, was born in the Soviet Union, and had a lot of money, and had a ring with a podparasha in it the size of a marble.
Okay, describe to us what a podparasha is.
It's the rarest sapphire.
Okay. And so what you're saying is that just from his jewelry and his money that he seemed to have, this would not be something that an E-2 would normally have.
Oh, no, he was CID. All the Marines knew it.
Okay. Explain for our audience what CID is.
That's sort of like internal affairs in the military.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay, now was he a patient at the hospital?
Supposedly.
Mm-hmm. But you guys were allowed to go out on leave, so, I mean, they didn't have you in lockdown.
Oh, no, no. No, he and I would go out on leave together, and we'd play shuffleboard for money and drinks or whatever. We'd go to the White Hats Club, and then we'd go out and about. And the real tip-off that Fedoreau was his last name, the real tip-off about Fedoreau was that he could go to a bathhouse. So he took me to a bathhouse one night.
Okay, now why is that a tip-off?
Because enlisted men are not allowed anywhere near Japanese bathhouses.
Okay.
They're off limits.
All right.
In fact, they won't let you in, but they let him in.
Mm-hmm.
With me. Of course, I didn't get very far because we drank too much. And as I'm taking my shoes off to put on the mat, I throw up on the mat. They throw me out, which is what they should do.
Okay. So, what's the significance of having this CID guy tagging along with you everywhere you go? What significance is there in that?
Well, it lets me know they knew what happened on the USS Kennebec.
So what do you think he was...
About the consequences of it.
Okay. I was going to ask, you think he was put next to you just to see what you talked about? Or, but now you've said they were aware of the possible consequences of it. So we'll pick up there when we come back from this break, all right? Folks, don't go away. There's more to this story, and I guarantee you this is interesting stuff. We are back, and my guest this evening is James Horak. And James, we were talking about what happened to you after this UFO encounter. One of the things I forgot to ask you is, how long do you estimate that this encounter took? In time, how much time did this encounter take?
From the first time that I was aware they were coming until I reacted, 7 minutes at the most, probably closer to five.
Okay. All right, so now you're over in the hospital in Akuska, and what I was getting into is a comment that you made that it having this guy sort of assigned to tag along with you everywhere you went indicated to you that they knew what some of the ramifications would be. What makes you think that was the reason, instead of maybe he was just there to listen and see what you would talk about?
Because I think that Fedoreau was encouraged to experiment with me.
Okay, elaborate on that a little bit.
To go out drinking, playing shuffleboard, the bathhouse, et cetera, to see how it would relate to other people, to see that what the effects of what happened might leave on me, to kind of poke me with a stick.
All right. After Ahuska, tell us, how long were you in the hospital at Ahuska?
About 6 weeks.
All right. Now, I assume that they were doing some medical test with you along the way?
I don't really think there was much testing because after an incident took place, I was kind of, it alarmed them, and they decided to send me back stateside very quickly.
All right. Tell us about that incident.
Federo and I had gone out, and it was the night the bathhouse incident, and he got back to the hospital before I did, and was waiting where you report into the OD and you sign in, and this third class petty officer was giving me some trouble. And so Federo said, what's your problem with him, or something like that. And so it made it things even worse. So we are walking down the hall towards our ward, and this guy's screaming at us and everything. So I tell Federo, get in this wheelchair. And so I start chasing this third class with Federo sitting in the wheelchair, shoving it just as fast as I can, and just scares the living devil out of him. So I get back to the ward. Now, Federo's not with me. I think Federo is trying to calm things down. But I get back to the ward, and there is a bunch of corpsmen waiting for me, and they... Two of them on each arm, and that was the wrong thing to do. I sling two of them against one wall and the other two against another wall, and then there are a bunch more. And I remember getting in a corner and just wailing the tar out of them. And in the middle of it all, a nurse, a very pretty nurse, walks up to me and says, "Do you want to hurt anyone?" And I said, "No, ma'am, I don't want to hurt anybody." And she took my hand and led me to a rack, which is a bed, and said, "Why don't you get under the cover?" And she sat there. I went to sleep, and the other guy said that she stayed with me quite a while, just holding my hand. Well, the next morning, they put me in the padded room with a straitjacket. I don't blame them.
And how long were you in the padded room with a straitjacket?
Yes.
How long were you in there?
Just until the morning. And she comes, the same nurse comes in, and she's fussing. "I told you not to do that to him," and all that. So they let me out, and all my buddies, who are mostly jarheads, start applauding. They were some of those hospital corpsmen they weren't too fond of.
Okay, so then what happens to you?
It's within a week, maybe 10 days, they decide to send me back on the MATS, Military Air Transport Service, which I guess at the time was a 727. I remember it pretty well, but it was airliner size.
Mm-hmm.
And just after they take me on, then they bring on eight men who are bandaged up like mummies, and they tell me they were burned in a stand-up bar in Tokyo that caught fire, and they're not expected to live long. That's what they tell me. And they strap us all into these racks, which are fastened to the inside fuselage, what we'd still in the Navy call a bulkhead.
Mm-hmm.
So we take off, and after we're in flight a little while, this nurse comes back and starts shooting us up with morphine. And after a while, that becomes a regimen, and she starts shooting me up with morphine, and every time she shoots them up, every time they start going into delirium and talking about friendly fire and stuff like that, she comes back there and shoots us all up with morphine, and I'm getting to feel this feather, like feathers, and I don't want any more damn morphine. So this fog, this blue fog, comes up inside that area of the plane, and you can see these gold specks in this fog, and she can't get in. She can't open the, she's up near the cockpit, she can't get in for any more of this morphine injections. So, I'm concerned about that I'm cutting these guys off from their painkillers.
So why is that? Were you causing this blue fog?
I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I can't really explain the cause and effect relationship going on. It's, I guess because it was under that damn morphine.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, she was giving me morphine every other hour or so with these other guys. Like, I mean, way too much.
Mm-hmm.
So, I start looking at these guys, and they're not going into delirium or complaining or anything. And, we get about 4 or 5 hours later, these guys start talking. I mean, they're not in delirium. And they start pulling bandages off. And they're not tied in like I am into their rack. I mean, I can't get out of my rack. So, a few more hours pass, and these guys have pulled all the bandages off. There's nothing wrong with them. They're talking about the bad dreams they had, and they're getting me out of my rack. And the blue fog is gone, and the nurse is standing there in shock. She hadn't moved for 30 or 40 minutes, just plastered, standing there looking at us. And we're hungry.
So what did they say had happened to them?
All I know is they had a bad dream. They think that they had been napalmed.
But they didn't have any burns on them.
No.
Hmm.
They were fine. They thought it was all a big joke.
All right, so the plane lands where?
Long Beach, California.
And what happens to you?
Now, we might have landed somewhere en route for refueling, but like Guam, somewhere, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm put in an, I think it was an Air Force hospital, because most of the people in there were in the Air Force, but I'm only there for a few days, and I'm in a co-ed ward that's only supposed to be for officers.
And you were not an officer.
Next.
Is that correct? You were not an officer.
No.
Okay. So they put you in a ward that's meant only for officers.
Right.
Okay. And then what?
Those enlisted won't have co-ed wards.
All right.
So the next thing nobody talks to me except other patients. They're all curious, but they don't know anything, and I'm not telling anybody anything. So next thing they do, now I'm in the Pacific Theater. They fly me across the country to the Philadelphia Naval Hospital. They bring a retired Captain Willoughby, who's a psychiatrist out of retirement. She was the only woman ever offered an admiralty at that time. She had been one of FDR's psychiatrists. Bring her out of retirement, and we had a couple of conversations, and that was it.
Now, somewhere along the way, somebody told you you had a very high blood white blood cell count similar to leukemia. Where did that happen?
That was on the way to the Westpac on that oiler, that tanker.
Mm-hmm.
We pearled into Pearl, and my legs from my ankles about halfway up the calf were so swollen you couldn't touch them. Puffed out, and I could barely walk.
All right, we're just a few seconds away from break, and I want to get this story in because I've got a question about that that I think we want to hear the answer to. And then we'll come back to this psychiatrist that came out of retirement. All right, folks, we're headed into a break. On the other side of this break, more with James Horak. Welcome back. You were telling us about this leukemia-like symptom they diagnosed you with, James. So this happened way back at the beginning of the process, though, right?
It happened on the way to Sasebo. We were pulling into Pearl Harbor, and as we were pulling in, I had this swelling in my ankles and lower calves, and it was kind of like the skin looked like a fish's belly, and there were little red spots.
Mm-hmm.
If you pushed in, it would stay, it wouldn't come out like it should.
Mm-hmm.
And it was extremely painful, and they tell me that my white blood cell count was in the leukemia range, and gave me some kind of antibiotic, and gave me orders to give the chief petty officer on the Kennebec directions to keep me in bed on my back for 2 weeks.
And did they do that? Did they keep you in bed?
No, I was out on deck working again the next day.
Is that legal under the military code?
No, but like I said, we had a captain that wasn't a good captain.
All right. Now, let's. I wanted to get that in because I have a question pertaining to that, but I'll ask it later. All right, so now they fly you all the way from the West Coast over to Philadelphia, right?
Yes.
And which hospital did they put you in Philadelphia?
Philadelphia Naval Hospital.
All right. While you were in that hospital on the West Coast where they had you in a ward for officers, do you remember them asking you a lot of questions? Did they question you about what you had seen or anything like that?
Some of the patients did. Some of them were curious. I mean, they just like normal. I can't remember talking to any doctors. A nurse came over and with a shot and I asked her what it was, and she said, well, you're going to need this probably for the rest of your life. And I said, no, I won't. And she said, you don't want the shot? And I said, no. It's about the only thing that I can remember. I mean, the food was good. There were women to look at. I mean, I'd been on a ship.
Yeah. All right. So they tell us about this flight across the country. Was it what they put you on Delta Airlines and send you over to Philadelphia? Or how'd they get you from the West Coast all the way to Philadelphia?
It was on a military airplane. I was the only passenger.
Mm-hmm. So you had a private flight?
A nurse or pilot or anything.
That's a little bit unusual, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, I thought so, because I was hungry.
All right, did you, you know, all the way through this, there's a theme. You were hungry. Have you noticed that?
Oh, yeah.
All the way through this thing, you know, you were hungry. Okay, so they put you on this flight. You're the only person on the flight other than the crew. And did they have you restrained or did they give you sedatives or anything like that before you get on this flight?
No, they just... there were seats. The plane was comfortable and wasn't strapped into a rack or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
And the light would go on when they wanted me to fasten my seat belt, and it'd go off when it wasn't necessary. Or it is pretty much like an airplane flight, but no company.
Mm-hmm. So you get to Philadelphia, you get off of the airplane. Is there anyone there to meet you, or how do you get from the airplane to the hospital?
There was a Marine and some corpsmen and a doctor, and I think that was it. They're all nice.
And you just get into a car and drive, or was it an ambulance or what?
It was a car. No, mm-hmm. Just a regular car.
All right, so, and this is at Bethesda? No.
I don't know where it was. I can't remember very much about the airport, but it didn't look like a big airport. It didn't look like a military base. So, it was at least an hour and a half from the hospital. Of course, when we got when we arrived, it was I guess about 10 in the morning. There wasn't any heavy traffic.
Okay, tell us the name of the hospital again.
Philadelphia Naval Hospital.
All I will say about Philadelphia Naval Hospital is, for those of you who follow this genre, that ought to ring some bells for you. All right. Now, James, you get to the hospital. They call this doctor, who is a psychiatrist, out of retirement. She had been one of FDR's doctors. And they call her out of retirement just to handle you. Is that the case?
That's what I was told. I had I had an infection in my mouth, and it was an oral surgeon that healed it. And I'm sitting listening to him talk while he's painting the roof of my mouth with ginseng violet. And he said, so they pulled that old lady out just for you. And I said, you mean Captain Willoughby? And he says, yeah. We haven't seen her around here in a long time. But that wasn't the first one that told me. They had pulled her out of retirement to deal with me. But, you know...
Don't you find it a little bit odd? I mean, if you were just a guy with a behavior problem, or you're just a guy with some sort of post-traumatic stress syndrome or something like that, doesn't it seem a little odd that you get this private military flight all the way across from where you're assigned, all the way across the country? Doesn't it seem a little odd that they had put you up in a ward that is reserved for officers? Doesn't it seem a little odd to you that they bring this psychiatrist out of retirement for you?
Oh, yeah.
What is there about you that would have caused all of this other than or except for the UFO incident? Is there anything else about you that would have caused this?
What happened when I was 4 years old?
Well, what happened when you were four? You know what? We have a break coming up in less than a minute, so you'll have to do it real quick.
Well, there was a UFO incident when we were coming to Texas from New Mexico.
Okay, and you shared that with us, I believe, in your first visit with us here at the show. All right, we're going to step away for a break, and that break, well, it's going to take over here in about 25 seconds. When we come back, normally, at this point, we would be opening up the phone lines. But we've got a lot more to cover here. And we're going to continue. If we have time in the show, we'd reach a point where we can open the phone lines, we'll do that. But I want you to hear this story. Because, ladies and gentlemen, it's one you haven't read in a book anywhere. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back. Those of you joining us just now have missed 16 universes, and I am sorry you missed it, but we're glad you're here now, and my guest is James Horak. James, I had asked about what happened to you when you were 4 years old, so let's pick up there.
I was born in Las Vegas, New Mexico. And my mother decided to come back to Texas where her folks were. And I was four at the time. And we were coming back, and I'm trying to think of the town that the first fairly sizable town, which is across from into New Mexico from Texas. I believe the highway's 287.
Okay.
And there's a curve there as you come out of town, and used to be some plaster teepees there, and then there's a railroad and a trellis and railroad lights. And so we were coming around that curve, and I'm looking over in a field, and I see this blue flame shooting out of the ground. And I ask my uncle, who's in the back seat with me, it was my uncle, and I said, what is that light? And he thinks I'm talking about the railroad lights, and so he starts telling me, and I say, no, and about that time, there's this white light that just permeates everything. I'm standing up in the seat, and I look over at my uncle, and he's just stationary. And I look at my mother, the car is conking out. I can hear that kind of like when it has after knock.
Mm-hmm.
We roll over on the shoulder. And my mother starts going floating out the window. And as she's about, a little ways out the window, this head sticks in the window. And when it sticks in the window, I have this revulsion. And something just leaves me. And this thing grabs its head, and I can hear it shrieking inside its head, and it starts running for this shaft of light. And I look out the window, and I have this surge of revulsion again, and then all of a sudden I hear this clanking noise, and sparks start flying, and this thing starts wobbling off to my left. And then after,
when you say this thing, you're talking about a UFO?
Hmm?
When you say this thing starts wobbling, you're talking about a UFO?
Yes.
Okay.
And I see another one, and I do the same thing, and it this time it makes a kind of a grinding, like you were taking two metal plates, and you press them real hard and rotated them.
Mm-hmm.
And it starts sparking and heading off in the same direction. And then I don't remember much after that, except my mother. I remember I look down and my mother is slumped over on the ground. And then the next thing I remember is a nurse is at the door, and I'm over against my uncle, and she says, come with me now, come with, and she's talking to me like that, and she reaches her hand over, and she's very, very nice, so next thing I remember, she's taking me into a tent, and there were four tents. I can remember they were white. They had a red cross. They were four-cornered. And they were in that field where I saw the flame shooting up out of the ground.
All right. So let's go forward now to the Naval Hospital in Philadelphia. How does what happened when you were four play into anything that's happening to you in Philadelphia? I mean, as far as that psychiatrist, as far as the treatment that you had been receiving, how does the incident when you were four factor into all of that?
I think they were keeping track of me.
When you say they, you mean the military or?
Yes.
Okay. So from the time you were four, you think they were watching you?
Well, after what happened in New Mexico, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I do, because there was a... we moved when my mother came to Texas. She met my stepfather, and we lived in Dublin. And it was not long... after that, I was not right around six. It was before I started school. We lived close to the movie theater, and I went to the movie theater, and something happened there which indicated to me that they were keeping track on me if I look back in retrospect. And that was what I told you about the Cleopatra movie and these men there that were demonstrating an enhancement of viewing pleasure.
And, mm-hmm.
What happened there indicates to me that yes, they had some kind of project going that involved me.
All right. So you have a conversation now with this Captain Willoughby. What was it, Captain? Was that the rank?
Yes, four-striper.
Okay, so Captain Willoughby has been called out of retirement to deal with you. And tell us about your conversations with Captain Willoughby.
Well, there were only two. The first one was the initial one, which was about a day or two after I'd been in the hospital. And then there was one whenever I was given a discharge, and she was giving me advice. In the first one, she called me in and asked me, what about those lights? And I said, oh, I knew they shouldn't have been there and they shouldn't be doing what they were doing, so I knew I was hallucinating. And that satisfied her completely.
Now, at the time you said that, did you say it for the purpose of throwing her off the track, dismissing the situation so you could gain your freedom? Is that why you said it? Or did you really think it was hallucination?
No, I knew what it was. And I knew they knew too, but I figured that was the best way to get the hell out of there.
Okay. All right. And then when she was giving you advice, as you were being discharged, was there anything in that advice that seemed that it related to those lights?
No, it was her advice amounted to this. She said, you may have some trouble in life, just avoid crowds. That's about all.
All right. I told you I have a question related to that leukemia-like symptom that was diagnosed, and here it is. Whatever happened to that?
I can't remember after I was put back to work being in pain or, I did not suffer. I took the antibiotic I was given, and I worked as if nothing was wrong, and I would take my shoes off and my socks off, and nobody said anything to me about it. They'd just say, doesn't that hurt? And I'd say, no, not as long as I don't try to wear my shoes or my socks. So, and I can't remember how long it took before I could wear my shoes and socks, but I know by the time we were in Sasebo, I was as good as new.
So you have leukemia-like symptoms that go away.
Yeah. Of course, the captain wanted to court-martial me because he thought I just allowed myself to get sunburned.
Mm. This guy sounds like a moron.
He liked to sit on the bridge and shoot at seagulls with the 45 APC.
Yeah, he's a moron.
Yeah.
All right.
Almost got me one day when I was on starboard watch.
Okay. Now, I think what we'll do, I think we will go ahead now and open up the telephone lines in case we have some folks in our audience that have a question or a comment that would like to talk with you. Folks, the telephone number is 623-444-5889. We have a toll-free number if you're in the USA or Canada. It is 888-223-4599. If you are not in the USA and you're not in Canada, I don't have a toll-free number that works for you. But I do have for you something called the Flash Message, and you can go to my website, which is kevinsmithshow.com, click where you see the link that says Flash Message, and you can send us your question or comment in that way. And let's go to the telephone. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, Kevin. This is Tracy from Canada.
Hi, Tracy.
Wow, that was fast. Hi, James.
Hello.
I have a question about that incident on the plane. Do you think that blue mist you saw healed those boys?
Beg your pardon?
Do you think that blue mist that you saw after you got the morphine, do you think it healed those boys, or they were never hurt?
I can't tell you. I have no way of knowing. I just know that it kept the nurse back towards the cockpit. I guess it was another little compartment between her and the cockpit that that door opened into. But it kept her back there. She didn't come back and give us any more of that morphine. And I don't think it did anything for the Marines either.
You don't think the fog did?
No, I don't think that the morphine was doing them any good.
No, probably not. Okay, I was just wondering about that.
Thank you, Tracy.
Really enjoyed it.
All right.
See you later.
Bye-bye. All right, the telephone lines are open, and the telephone number, the main number here in the studio, is 623-444-5889, or toll-free 888-223-4599. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name, and from where are you calling? Hello, caller.
Hello, this is Mark.
Mark. Okay, Mark, you're on the air. You're okay. Where are you calling from?
I'm a first-time caller from Globe, Arizona.
From Globe. I know right where Globe is. All right, let's get some applause for you. All right, Mark, what's on your mind?
Thanks very much. It's a real pleasure to talk to you, Kevin, and to you, James. I really appreciate all the information you've been giving us over your visits here on this show. James, you told us the functions of the EMVs and the decision that you've been tasked with. So I'm wondering, if we see a major CME hit the Earth and cause some serious damage, could we then assume that your decision has been made and therefore more CMEs will continue hitting the Earth until all humans have died?
I pray that that's not going to happen. It's not my decision. I am part of the mechanism, but I don't want that to happen, and I don't want an ultimatum given. But I do want to be as informative to people that are in fear, to people that are looking for answers, to people that need hope. I want them to know that the truth has been misrepresented, that there is going to be an attempt to pose ETs as hostile, and they are not, that what is going on is not in their interest, and that they have options, and they have reason to hope.
Understand. So you're saying then that a decision might be made. You said you're a part of the mechanism, so that means a decision could be made, even if you'd rather not have it made one way, it might be made that way anyway?
Well, the decision will be made when there is a program of depopulation which is initiated and begun to be executed. When that happens, yes, the decision will be made.
Understand. Thank you very much.
Mark, I have a question for you.
Yes.
You were talking about if there is a major CME that hits the Earth. Are you aware of the fact that yesterday there was a report on the Internet of a major, major CME? However, because of its location on the sun, it will not have a direct hit on the Earth. But were you aware of that?
I was aware over the last few days that there was one that was supposed to possibly hit a couple days ago. I thought another one was maybe in the next couple days, but I wasn't following them real closely.
Yeah. Well, the report that I saw has disappeared from the Internet.
Oh, how interesting.
Isn't it? All right. Thanks for the call.
Thank you very much.
Bye. All right. 623-444-5889. Toll free 888-223-4599. If you're not in the USA and you're not in Canada, you can send me a flash message And I'll read it, provided it has to do with tonight's show. We'll read it on the air and ask James to respond to it. James, I'm not going to ask this in a way that identifies any incident or that identifies any location. So this is a very sort of generic when it comes to the details. And yet, I think both you and I will recognize what I'm talking about. But have you, in the course of all that you've talked about here tonight, run into other people who were subjected to anomalous events and then secluded in hospitals? I'm sorry, we didn't hear you.
Yes, I have.
Okay. All right, back to the telephone caller. You're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, Kev. Hi, James. It's Boomer calling from Ladysmith, B.C.
All right, Boomer.
How are you guys tonight?
Good, thanks.
Fine.
Good. James, two quick questions. Did this revulsion with these ETs, is it because they're soulless entities?
No, it's EBs, not ETs. And it's very important to distinguish between the two. And you're correct. They have no souls. They are
okay. Are they the Ebens or whatever they're called? Those manufactured entities.
Yes.
Okay. And real quick, Kevin, you know I've got the high-end night vision goggles. Just for your information, I've had them for a little over 2 years. I do a lot of you know night sky watching. Last night I saw you know more unbelievable vehicles, so to speak, than I have in the 2 years put together, and I'm just wondering, boy, it's like they're not even trying to hide themselves now, and I'm just wondering if James has you know, any thoughts on that? Now I'll take the answer off the air. Thanks, guys.
All right. James, what he's talking about is if you take night vision, high-grade night vision equipment, and look up into the sky at nighttime, just about any night from just about any location, you can see unidentified flying objects very, very high up. They're in space because they're up high enough for the sun to reflect on them. And that's what he's talking about. Do you know anything about this? These vehicles that seem to be out there virtually every night?
Yes, but there is a feature of observation where you have an arrested time sequence. And a lot of times when you capture these things, what you're doing is you're capturing them in spatial time. And you're actually getting a freeze of the events over a much longer period of time than your view. And that is a situation when you're looking into an area under an artificial circumstance, like a vortex,
mm-hmm.
or an area of the sky that has had various anomaly leave a residue. And this sort of thing happens near where I live frequently. I would say if you wanted to find something like that, you could go outside, say, towards evening, when you still had good light, in my backyard, and look towards the west, and you will see an anomaly of that sort at least three times in 1 week if you go out there every late afternoon.
Mm-hmm. Well, then what he's talking about is at nighttime when it's dark.
Yes. Well, I can understand a situation where you'll see them more occasionally, but to see a number of them at any one time suggests to me that he's looking at a residue of happenings that are impressed upon what he's, his field of view. This has happened, but it isn't happening in the duration or in the short duration of his view. It's a residue of what's happened maybe over the last 8 hours.
Hmm. That's the first time I've heard that. All right, folks, the telephone number is 623-444-5889. The toll-free number is 888-223-4599. And, of course, we have our Flash message board. Leonardo in Puerto Rico has sent me a Flash message. It says, great show tonight, Kevin. Please ask your guest, what is it that he does to make the ETs or UFOs malfunction, and how is it possible that he, as an organic being, can read the minds of beings that are part machines? Good questions. So what do you do to zap them? And let me say to our caller, just hang on, we'll get to you. Well, I'll tell you what. I just looked at the clock, and we're 6 seconds away from break. So we'll get to Leonardo's questions. And caller, can you hang on through the break?
Yes, I can.
All right. We'll be back right after this, folks. Back to the Kevin Smith Show and my guest, James Horak. James, tell you what I want to do. This caller's been holding for a while. Let's take this call, and then we'll do that flash message. Caller, your first name, and from where are you calling?
Hi, Kevin. This is Mark from Ohio.
Hi, Mark.
Hello, Kevin. I have two questions for James. First of all, James, are the civilizations on other planets made up of souls that are in biological bodies like us here on Earth, or do those souls and other civilizations inhabit different kinds of bodies than biological ones?
Mark, I could only hear the first part. I'll answer that. Yes, they're very much like us.
Okay. Are there inhabited planets in this solar system besides Earth? And if so, can you tell us about them?
They're planets that have colonies on them in this solar system. The civilization, for the most part, with the exception of the moons of Jupiter.
Well, what do you mean by that, James?
Well, they're people on two of the moons of Jupiter.
Okay. Mark, does that answer your question?
Yes, that's very fascinating, James. I'll listen off the air, but that certainly could use some other questions, Kevin. Thank you very much.
All right, thanks. 623-444-5889 is the number here in the studio, or toll-free in the USA and Canada. You can call us at 888-223-4599. I want us to get to this flash message that I read from Leonardo. Let me read it again. What is it that you do that makes the ETs and UFOs malfunction? But now, you said they're not ETs, they're EBs. Okay. And then how is it possible that you, being an organic being, can read the minds of beings that are part machines?
Well, I just understand the technology of their machines, and I understand how to communicate, and I understand what their limitations are. The machines operate on attenuation of the gravity wave, and Normally, that would be very stable method of travel, but they have to receive their information simultaneous with a computer, and that's not difficult to mess with at all. It's a delicate combination of information and what's already built into the metal of the UFO, and how it carries on a symbiotic relationship with the EB.
Okay, so
that's with any aspect of it, and it's over for them.
Okay, well, how do you mess with it?
That's difficult to explain. It's a matter basically of it's a form of intrusion. It comes through the will, and then it comes in me. It comes out through this revulsion that I feel. It's like I can see it before I do it, and it happens.
Okay. All right, folks. The telephone lines are open, and the telephone number is 623-444-5889. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yeah, good evening, gentlemen. This is Terry from Ohio.
Hello, Terry.
Hi, Kevin. I got a question for your guest. As archaeological goes, and ET, is there something that's hidden, like the hall records, like in Egypt or whatever, that either the government already found or we will find that will enlighten us? And it doesn't even have to be just that hall records. Maybe it could be something else that you know about. And I'll listen offline. Thanks.
All right.
The best source of revelatory information that's suppressed is in the Etruscan room at Cambridge.
Has anybody seen those and been able to read them?
I know that I have in the Jesuit Library in the Vatican. I have seen some of they have a few of those scrolls. And Cambridge, all the tombs, the Etruscan tombs around Rome, were looted by one Englishman, a wealthy Englishman, and he donated the entirety of his collection to Cambridge. It's kept under lock and key, and only the director of antiquities, the person that holds the chair at Cambridge of the director of antiquities, is allowed in that room and has that key.
So when we talk about all of the secret books and hidden books and documents in the Vatican, even though that's obviously the case, it's not the only place where there are these secret hidden documents.
That's true. They've spoken before of the Hall of Records supposed to be between the feet of the Sphinx. Now, it of course hasn't been there for many, many centuries. It was probably some form of time capsule. Time capsules are found occasionally, but they're suppressed when they're found. They're secreted before they're opened. And you find accounts of this from time to time. I'm trying to think of a book that mentions something about a time capsule being found. I think it's God's Graves and Scholars, or it's Testaments of Time, which has an account of a time capsule that was found and spirited off.
You know, I was just thinking about time capsules the other day, and I was reading an article about some people that did a time capsule, And part of what they did was they made a videotape and put it in there. Well, you know, folks, it was a VHS tape, and not too many people have VHS players now. I don't know that you can even buy one. Maybe you can. I don't know. But it won't be too much longer until you can't buy one. If they're still available now, they won't be available 10 years from now. And so it would do no good to have something like that in a time capsule, because the means to play it back won't exist for very far into the future. Technology changes so fast. So I guess, you know, maybe you could write it down on a piece of paper, a message for the future, but paper degrades over time. And really, about the best medium that you could record our current history, about the best medium that you could record it on would be stone or metal. Would you agree, James?
Oh, yes. Well, we lost most of the Aztec, Inca, and Mayan writings, and they had libraries because the Spanish thought that they should be destroyed. And some of the codices have survived, like the Marlboro, which is probably the best. But you have to bear in mind that archaeologists are not so wonderful all the time. I remember an account where at Thebes they had discovered this dump that went back hundreds of years. And in it were all these scroll cases with scrolls inside. And these young archaeologists were out there, and they'd open the scroll case and throw the scroll up in the air and watch it disintegrate when it hit the air.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right. Now, I want us to get back to something you said to one of our callers, I believe to Mark in Ohio. You said there are two of the moons of Jupiter. Was it Jupiter that you said are populated?
Yes.
Can you tell us something about those? Which moons are they?
Ganymede, if you look at some of the images, NASA images of Ganymede, it has a thin crust of ice. By thin, I mean thin enough that you can see forms underneath it. And if you look at them closely, now I'm not sure, I mean, if these are still available or if they're as sharp as they once were, but you can look at them, and it doesn't require an active imagination to see cities under that ice.
Okay, but if they're under ice, wouldn't it indicate that they're in ruins and people are not living there now?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, you can create out of any environment very habitable surroundings with a little bit of ingenuity, and these people are way ahead of us on that. On that scale.
Well, you know, since you mentioned it, that's true. Every year, you know, there's that ice hotel that's so famous. Okay, caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yeah, Kevin, it's Terry from Ohio again. Nobody's calling tonight, huh? I just got one more question. Would you ask him about...
No, I won't, but you can.
Oh, okay. Well, I need you to explain it more, because I can't remember. Like, but remember you showed those photos? I think they're in Peru with, like, machinery underneath the water in these holes on the mountains.
Mm-hmm.
Could you ask him if he knows?
No, you can.
What they are and who put them there.
Okay.
And thanks. I'll be offline.
All right. He can hear you when you call in, so you can ask the question. In the Andes, there are these lakes that have very, very clear water. And I mean very high up in the Andes. And satellite photographs of those show buildings and what looks like machinery down in the bottom of those lakes. Do you know anything about those?
Well, there are several places on Earth where there are operations that are ongoing, and they're ET operations. And one of them is in Utah that I've spoken about and tried to get people interested in visiting, because there's an ongoing alien, or not, I don't like the word alien, there is an ongoing ET operation there that will always be there, has been there since long before Utah was settled.
All right, we have to take a break. We'll be back right after this. We'll pick up right there. Final approach. A quick reminder, if you are not subscribed to the K-Files, be sure you do. And if you're not a member, what are you waiting for? It's 23 cents a day. Come on. All right. James Horak is our guest. And James, you were telling us about this place in Utah. Go ahead and tell us about that, but then tell us if you know something about these places up in the Andes.
Well, there are a number of underground connections that are channeled together, and the Andes is one hot spot for this sort of thing. It is a kind of mining, but it isn't mining like we do, like modern man here does. This is something that like what the EMVs do, and that's what goes on in Utah. That's what's going on in the Andes. Now, I'd have to look at these photographs before I could tell you much more than that about them. I'm not familiar with them, but I do know that there are operations in the Andes, and the crater lakes. Almost all of the crater lakes lend themselves very well to this type of mining activity.
What are they mining for?
There, remember what I was saying about the Platinum Group when we talked? The platinum group metals observe some very interesting interrelationships, and the what defines one from the other is arbitrary. They're different kinds of enrichment. In supergene enrichment, there are two factors that are involved, and then this kind of enrichment, which is enriching a solid with a gas, basically, there's a process which is easily utilized for other things. And so they can take the boundaries of a supergene host and use this in ways to affect biological advantages for growth, for repair, for a number of things. And of course, this is not, they can do it in such a way that it does not take anything from the deposit. It doesn't take anything from the resources.
They just use it as sort of an agent for the process.
Yes, it's it would be exploitation in any other way, and that's what's going on in Utah. The process is similar to that because they're not exploiting. What they're doing is they're opportunizing something that's not going to cost anybody anything. In fact, maybe improve it. Maybe make the crust of the earth stronger. Make the plate tectonics more stable. Ensure a greater lineage to the host planet for civilization.
Well, it would seem that if they're going to do anything to make the plate tectonics more stable, they need to hurry because it's cracking up and we're having huge earthquakes everywhere.
Well, they're not responsible for that. There's an agenda behind that, and that's earth-driven.
So you're saying these earthquakes that have been happening everywhere, just had one in China. Almost 600 people listed as killed in that earthquake. And you're saying that someone here on Earth is causing that?
Yes. I'll give you an example of what I'm talking about. The frequency of the earthquakes and their lack of an analytical pattern, but more like demonstration earthquakes,
mm-hmm.
suggest by the absence of uplift that this suspicion is valid. And they have the technology to do it. Of course, it goes very well with, you need a new world order. This is just another reason why you need somebody to take charge and all that crap.
Mm-hmm. So... is there a government behind this, or is it shadow government that is kind of multinational?
Yes, globalism.
That's what's behind it.
Yes. If somebody can give you, let's put it this way, somebody can give you a valid reason for HAARP, for instance, that explains... any benefit to humanity whatsoever and not just cloak it in secrecy, I would be amazed.
But did you know, I read an article within the past 2 weeks that said that HAARP is pretty much the baby on the block, and that the real one, the big one, is in Alaska. And I believe, and I could have this wrong, but I believe it was called the FIPA, the FIPA or FIPA. And that's one I had not heard of. But they say that that article said that it's in Alaska. And that the one that we all know about, HAARP, is the baby.
Well, there's something in Australia. There's something in Antarctica. They're doing things that are alarm causing. It's like everything that you would assume a stable society would promote, they're going the other way with. It's social engineering. Now, you can, when plate tectonics move, when plates move, generally what causes the earth upheaval is a buildup on the shorelines of continents of the eroded material from mountains and plains that end up being washed there, and eventually they build up the pressure and cause a general uplift. That pattern is not there.
Okay.
Anywhere. It's not in Southeast Asia, in the Pacific Rim. It's not in California. You have the San Andreas Fault in Mid-America. You have a series of fractured faults which are becoming more and more unstable.
Mm-hmm.
But no uplift, no sign. signs of uplift, no signs of the mechanism upon which this normally would work. But you're having these earthquakes, and you're having them at odd times and odd. They're a seismologist's nightmare.
James, I hate to do it, but we're at the end of the show. I want to thank you for being with us again.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
All right. Stay online with me for a moment. Okay, folks, I've reached the end of the road for tonight's show. We have reached the end of the road for tonight's show. And I just want to thank James for being here. Thank you for being here. And I hope you've enjoyed it. Very, very interesting story. All right. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too. You can call me whatever you want to call me. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.